Wednesday, April 30th, 2025. You are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, coming to you from the Mile High City here in Denver, Colorado, and we are back for another week of talking sports with a dose of common sense. Hey, happy Wednesday to you. I hope your week is going well. I hope you, your family, your friends, everyone in your world is staying strong and healthy right now. And I hope you're doing better than Shedeur Sanders. No, we're not going to talk about Shedeur slipping in the NFL draft. I mean, if I did, what in the world would ESPN do for the next 3 months? I don't want to put poor Mrs. Deion Sanders out of work. Mel Kiper Jr. Hey, we have the NBA playoffs going right now. And yes, we have those Stanley Cup playoffs going in the NHL. And I'm telling you right now, that has been fascinating to watch. You know, every single series in the Western Conference was tied at 2-2. It is going to be a wild run to the Stanley Cup. Well, today, we are going to be joined by a guy that really knows the game. And in fact, we have so much to get to, we need to jump in right now. Joining us this week on the Daily Dose, we have got a very special guest that honestly, I can't wait to talk to. Because Bruce Dobigan is a Canadian sports broadcaster, journalist, and writer. He is a two-time winner of the Gemini Award as Canada's top television sports broadcaster. His latest book is called Deal With It, The Trades That Stunned the NHL and Changed Hockey. You can get that on Amazon. He has Inexact Science, The Six Most Compelling Draft Years in NHL History. That was his previous book with his son, Evan. That was voted, by the way, the seventh best professional hockey book of all time by Book Authority. His 2005 book, Money Players, was a finalist for the Canadian Business Book of the Year. He has now written like a dozen books. You can find them pretty much anywhere, or you can go to brucedobiganbooks.ca. Find them wherever books are sold. This guy knows hockey backward, forward, sideways. I can't wait to talk to him about hockey and the Stanley Cup playoffs and everything else. Bruce, welcome to the Daily Dose. We are happy to have you here with us today.
It's great to be here and nice to meet you, Ken.
Thank you. Hey, Bruce, I've got a question. Where did you grow up? What is your background? Where did you grow up at?
Well, I grew up in Montreal in the province of Quebec. Strangely enough, I was not a Canadiens fan. I was a Red Wings fan. I grew up in the 60s and 70s as a Red Wings fan because of Gordie Howe. Just as a side story, I have four brothers, two older and two younger. And in those days, we used to play the tabletop hockey games. Sure. My father bought one for Christmas one year, and he said, well, you can't all have the same team. So my eldest brother took the Canadiens, my next brother took the Leafs, and I was left to choose somebody. And so it was the Red Wings. And so I spent a long time growing up in Quebec getting in fights at recess with guys over hockey games. And the Red Wings in those days were very good with Gordie Howe, but they just never won the big game. And so my life was a little miserable there. But yes, I was there for about 20 years and then moved to Toronto for about 25 years where I did a lot of my broadcasting and stuff. And I've been in Calgary now for 25 years. So yeah. Well, that's 75. Okay. Yeah, it's okay. I'm 70. So yeah, that the math works out.
The math is pretty good. Bruce, were you an athlete growing up? Did you play yourself?
I played all the sports like most guys in those days. The sport I played the most at the highest level was football. But I played hockey and all those sports until I was probably 16 or 17. And then I concentrated on football from then on. But I mean, you live hockey. And in those days in particular, you lived hockey all the time. It wasn't something you could avoid. You might be a baseball fan or a football fan, but you also had to know hockey to get along with people.
Sure, absolutely. So the Red Wings were your team, though. That was the team you were following. Gordie Howe was the guy. Is that who you were emulating? Is that who you were going out on the ice yourself and kind of emulating?
Well, certainly Gordie with the elbows, getting the elbows up and protecting himself. Yeah, no, Gordie was the guy, and he was a very sort of humble guy, really. He was tough on the ice, very productive guy, but a very modest guy. And I was very fortunate later on in life to get to know him and meet him a number of times. And he was a wonderful guy. Sometimes, you know, in our business, and you may have experienced this too, you'll have a hero or some guy that you really like or some woman that you really like. And then you'll meet them and you'll go, ooh. Maybe I shouldn't have met them. But with Gordie Howe, he was the real deal. And that was the original six hockey. I was born in 1954. So the 60s and 70s were really the prime of me watching hockey. And as I say, unfortunately, the Red Wings took a long time to get good again. They didn't get good again until, of course, the 1990s after that. Yeah. And then had some great series with the Avalanche.
Of course. Yes, they did. You know, Gordie Howe was an interesting guy because he was ahead of his time. We're now seeing guys come in and they can do a little bit of everything. Hey, they can fight a little bit. They can play some defense. They can be offensive threats. You look at a guy like Makar, he's not the fighter maybe, but hey, that was Gordie. That's Gordie Howe now. I know that in this generation, I think every generation does it. We like to look at, well, this guy today is better than that guy been. I don't like to do that. I like to look at it and say, this guy is who that guy would be if he had grown up in this system. And I think that's so much more, it's such a more fun way to look at it. A guy like a Cale Makar that can be such a great defenseman, can also just be an absolute sniper. He's kind of this generation's Gordie Howe, isn't he?
Yeah, to a certain extent. Makar, by the way, a good Calgary boy. We should
absolutely
throw that in there. Each of the greatest players, and in the book Deal With It, when we talk about the trades, they almost all involve guys who are the defining people of their generations. People like Wayne Gretzky, people like Patrick Roy, et cetera. And they kind of defined what it took to be a great player. And to be a great player in the original six with Gordie Howe, you had to do what they called the Gordie Howe hat trick, a goal, an assist, and a fight. You had to be prepared to do that. That was the price of staying in the NHL at that time. By the time Gretzky comes around, he doesn't have to do the fighting part. There's people who are protecting him. And so he redefines the game because he doesn't have to look over his shoulder. He doesn't have to worry who's coming the other way. He's being protected. So each guy in this time defines things. Patrick, and again, we get into it in the chapter in the book that we spent on the Patrick Roy trade. Patrick kind of defined goaltenders, the style of goaltenders. He changed the way you had to do it. And that's what's fun about each generation. And Makar and a couple, well, I guess, Ovi is a guy who's somewhat defined the generation, but Makar certainly is on his way to doing that. And it tells you what kind of player he is, but it also tells you what kind of hockey they played at that era. If you come back like 100 years from now and say, well, how did they play hockey in the 2020s? And you can point to a guy like Makar and say, that was the style.
Yeah, for sure. Bruce, how did you get into the sports media world? You were an athlete. You were, you know, a school kid, as all of us were. How did you go into that sports media world?
Well, you know, I'd grown up loving sports, but I kind of went sideways. I was working for a little while in the theater and in the movies and doing things like that because I wanted to write. And I had just gotten married in Montreal, and I needed a job, really, and because I, you know, I had to help support my wife. She was working too, but anyhow, I had to support myself, and I took what I thought was a part-time job as the sports editor for the Canadian version of TV Guide magazine. Remember the little thing that you, the book that used to sit on the TV? Well,
absolutely.
We had our TV Guide version in Canada. And just as a sort of a side thing, I took a job there as the sports editor for them. And that one thing led to to another, and I would get onto panels. And one day I was on a morning sports radio panel, and I came in the door, and a friend of mine worked at the place, and he said, they just fired the sportscaster. Tell them you can do it. And I said, well, I've never done live radio. Oh, no, you can figure it out. You can figure it out. And so I volunteered to do the job because it was the 1984 Olympics and most of the other sportscasters were out of town. So I said, I'll fill in. And that's how I got started in radio. And then 2 years later, I had the same thing happen. I got a phone call out of the blue from a TV producer who was producing the 6 o'clock sports, 6 o'clock news in Toronto, which was the biggest newscast in the country. And he said, I want you to be my sportscaster. And again, I said, well, I haven't done TV before. And he said, we'll teach you. Don't worry. What I've heard of you on the radio, you're going to work out. And that's how it got started. And the next thing I knew, I was winning the Canadian equivalent of the Emmy Award and all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, it was and all these guys I knew who were trying to get into the business, and I kind of fell into it sideways accidentally. And so I always kind of feel badly that these guys worked so hard in small places like Moose Jaw and Winnipeg, these Canadian cities. And, you know, I got right into the number one market.
That is outstanding. And hey, you know, one of the biggest lessons I take from that, if you get a chance, you know, go with it and run with it. And you never know. When you look back at those days of the sports media world compared to now, what are the biggest differences you see in how sports are covered?
Well, I mean, totally different news and sports, both.
But, no, you're right.
At 11 o'clock, when the 11 o'clock newscast, the local newscast, which you would have had in Denver, you'd have had in Toronto, you'd have had in Montreal, whatever. When that was over at 11:30, that was it. There was no more show on those TV channels, a news channel, until 6 o'clock the next night. There was no 4:30 or 5 early news or any of that stuff. So if the story wasn't done by a certain period of time at night, you just basically put it to bed, came back at it the next day. Now, of course, it's a 24-hour cycle. The news goes 24/7, 365, and you always have to be on top of stuff. And then, of course, social media came in, and social media made everybody know more than they'd ever known before. When I started again in doing sports radio and TV, you really were the one who controlled the story. Your take on the game last night was the one a lot of people had because it was all they had to listen to. But now in those days, again, and I'm sure it was the same in Denver, you didn't get every basketball or hockey game. You'd have maybe two a week or whatever. There would be games that were only on radio, some that you'd never even heard of. So anyhow, you had a chance as a sportscaster to define the way the games were seen and heard. He was a bum, he was good, whatever it was. And very much a privilege to do it. And then, as I say, social media changed all of that. Now everybody can see all the same stuff. And it's really hard to be different. I was able to be different because I had a background in theater and movies and stuff like that. So I've had a little bit different approach. Today there's 10 million podcasts and newscasts, etc. So it's really hard to stick out, and it's really hard to have an independent voice. And I feel for the people who are trying to start out today.
Bruce, is there? And I know you just spoke about it a little bit. There was a time in that era where you didn't get every game. I know for me, Monday Night Football was a big thing because you only got two or three games all weekend. So when you got a chance to watch it, is there an era that you kind of miss? Do you miss that era? I know we're spoiled now. We get every game. You can see it. Yep. But there's part of that I kind of miss.
I did a book about 8 or 9 years ago called Cap in Hand. And it was basically my rant against salary caps. I'm not one of these people that thinks that salary caps is the cure-all for everything that's wrong with sports leagues. I really think that salary caps have done a lot to hurt sports leagues and hurt competitiveness. It's produced tanking. It's produced a lot of things. But one of the big things that came out of it, what I wrote a lot about in the book, was this idea that you're getting at. There's so much content today. There is so much product that they're pushing on you at any one time. It almost overwhelms you, even if you're a big hockey fan, even if you're a big Avs fan or a Calgary Flames fan. It can get a little mind-numbing at a certain point because it's all there in front of you. There's never any mystery. Oh, you know, what happened last night? Again, picking up the paper in the morning to read what had happened the night before or hearing the radio guy in the morning. That doesn't exist anymore. And I think it's a problem that the leagues have to come to grips with. They're trying to do it a little bit. You've seen in basketball where they had this mid-season tournament sort of play-in thing, the four nations that they had in the NHL this year. These are all things that they're using to try to break up the season because even the most loyal fans go, you know, it's almost too much. It's almost too much stuff.
Yeah, it is. Is there an era that you look back on and you're like, that was my favorite era? That it wasn't even close. I know for me, you know, especially with football and basketball, you know, late 70s, early 80s for me, when it was the biggest thing on. It was so exciting when you got to see those games. And I know if I went back and watched it, I'd go, this really isn't that good of a product, but I still romanticize it. I still want to go back to it. Is there an era you look back as your favorite era?
Well, up until the time when I started working in the business, I was a fan. I always operated as a fan. And you know, I had teams that I rooted for. I rooted for the Montreal Expos. There were years that they're really great because I was invested as a fan. But once I got into the business, and I tell people who get into the business about lose your fandom at the door, I said, cheer for a good story. And so over the years, I've done books that have involved all sorts of things. I spent 6 years following the Vancouver Canucks when a friend of mine became the general manager of the team. And I got really invested in that and really interested in everything that was going on with Vancouver. And, of course, they came within a game of the Stanley Cup in 2011. The Calgary Flames have had a couple of years here where they went to the finals. And, you know, that was a gripping story. Other sports, when I was in Toronto, the Toronto Blue Jays won back-to-back World Series, and I was the local sportscaster. So those kind of things are, you know, I rooted for those stories at that time. They were fascinating. They were fascinating people. And when you can pick and choose, when you're in a big metropolitan area like Denver is, or like Toronto was, you've got the four or five teams. So if there's a couple that aren't doing too well, you just put them to the side and then concentrate on who's successful at that point. So I did a little bit of that, but that's what I would say. If I could digress just a little bit about the book, one of the things we did with Deal With It is we chose seven different big trades, and we chose each of them to represent a certain period of time in the NHL. How did they speak to the NHL? The earliest trade is Phil Esposito going to the Bruins, joining Bobby Orr. It was a simple time, and you made trades of one guy for another. And then as we go through the trades over the years, of course, you got Gretzky. This is the trade where Edmonton can't afford him anymore. LA becomes a big deal. Hockey in the south of the United States becomes a big deal. The Patrick Roy trade is a significant trade again, because he's going to a market that has just started to have NHL hockey. He legitimizes it, and he legitimizes a certain kind of way of playing sports. And the final two chapters, one of them is about the Vegas Golden Knights, who I think on their draft day made 15 different trades to build their team, and were a Stanley Cup winner right within 5 years. Yeah. And the last trade in the book is the Matthew Tkachuk trade, where he was traded from here in Calgary to Florida, and they go on to win the Stanley Cup. And each of those trades represented kind of the way business was done at that time. And it's certainly not the same as it was in 67 when Phil Esposito was traded. And it's certainly not the way it is today in 2024, 25. It's a very different way of doing business.
You have covered some of the greats. You have covered some of the biggest names on the planet. Is there one you hold a special place for? Is there one that you're like, no, that guy just impressed the heck out of me. Just a good guy.
Well, one of the things I did when I was doing local TV in Toronto, and one of the things that got me some of the awards, was I did a lot of work with the retired NHL players when they were suing the NHL over their pension. This is 1992, 93. And the NHL had taken some of their pension money for themselves, and the players went to court in Toronto to get that money back, and they were successful. And as a result of that, I met all sorts of guys who had been my heroes when I was a boy. In particular, Carl Brewer, who was a defenseman for the Leafs in the '60s when they won four Stanley Cups. We became really good friends, and so I would meet people. And again, I mentioned Gordie Howe. I got a promotion while I was at CBC doing television from local to national, and so they had a little party for me one night. And we're all standing around the bar with our friends just yakking away. And all of a sudden, the front door of the bar opens, and here comes Carl Brewer and Gordie Howe. And Carl's brought Gordie to my party. And he stood at the bar with us for about an hour. He was it was gracious, but he was also funny. He teased guys. You know, guys would talk to him, and he'd sort of take the pee out of him a little bit. Yeah. He was everything you really wanted him to have been. So that's a story I'll never forget.
Absolutely. That's amazing. You've broken a lot of stories. You were in that business of going in and finding those kind of stories. I know now it is such a big thing to break a story. Yeah. You see these guys battling on social media. So-and-so broke this and I broke this and he broke this. And yeah. Did you ever have a story like that you broke that you were especially proud of?
Oh yeah. I mean, again, I got involved, first of all, as I say, with the NHL over the pension lawsuit, but then I got involved with the guy who was the head of the union at the time, Allan Eagleson, who was corrupt. And there were a lot of players who had complained to me about him over the years. And at some point I decided, you know, I'm going to look into this story. And with another reporter in Boston, a man named Russ Conway, together, we investigated the story for almost 7 or 8 years before Allan Eagleson went to jail. We worked on that story the whole time, and we found out the corruption. We found out for instance, I'd mentioned Mike Gillis, who was the general manager of the Vancouver Canucks. He was a client of Eagleson's, and he had a broken leg that ended his career, and Eagleson took some of his disability insurance money. That's just the idea of how corrupt a guy he was. And from Russ, who was an old-time investigative reporter, I learned how to do those stories. Up until then, I was just, you know, a desk sports guy. I had some things to say. I was like a lot of guys. But I was able, through this story, to kind of, you know, get my bona fides as a reporter, as an investigative reporter. And it was scary sometimes. And the biggest, to be honest with you, Clint, the biggest fear I always had was, why am I the only guy who thinks that this is a story? I was breaking stories about we discovered this or we discovered this money here, whatever. And I thought, why is nobody else doing this story? At some point, they're going to come out with a silver bullet and I'm going to look like an idiot. But it never happened. We were right the whole time. Our research was right. And as I say, he ended up going to jail eventually. And it was a very gratifying thing. And it was gratifying to be able to help players and people. Because, you know, in our business, over the years, you meet lots of people. But how many did you help? Well, you know, it was a big event you were at and you reported and they liked your reporting or something. But to get to the end of my business day and say, you know what, I helped all of these players who were my boyhood heroes to get their pension money, to get rid of a corrupt union official, to reform their association. That was a very gratifying feeling for somebody in our business.
Oh, I bet it had to be. Because of that, was that the favorite story you ever covered? Or did you have something else that you're like, no, there's another one out there. But I would imagine that one had to be pretty high on your list.
That was the biggest. But and it went off in different directions. As I said, there was a pension aspect to it. There was the union aspect of it. There's some other things. That led also to a couple of other agents who were corrupt, who I investigated as a result of that. But, you know, as a story, you know, I had some human interest stories, too. And a couple of my friends who were in the hockey business who were announcers, unfortunately, their sons died of drug overdoses. And they thought enough of me to do their stories. This is when I was doing newspaper work. So that was gratifying because I brought a story that was a human interest story. It was a little bit different. So, but, you know, in terms of you can't beat that. The stuff about the NHL Players Association and Allen Eagleson and all those people. I still get people today who come up to me and remember that me doing those stories and say, thank you. Thank you for cleaning up hockey.
That's absolutely unbelievable. Hey, just a quick reminder, make sure you're stopping by DailyDoseSports.com each and every week. We've got new articles that go up there each week that I contribute. We've got links to the podcast. We've got links to the videos. And yes, we have links to Daily Dose gear. You might need a new t-shirt, a new sweatshirt, a new hat. I actually did see someone wearing a new Daily Dose hat recently. Kind of like the look of that. You can order them in the colors that you want, which is kind of nice. But make sure you are stopping by DailyDoseSports.com each and every week to check on what is going on over there. I know you're a Red Wings fan. I know our history here in Colorado with the Red Wings. What do you remember from that just unbelievable rivalry?
I remember it was unbelievable. Actually,
it really was. It was kind of surreal.
It had come out of the era, the Flyers era and the 80s when, you know, hockey was very violent. There was fighting and all that sort of stuff. And Gretzky had made it more of a skill game. And we'd gotten away from it. There was still fighting and all that type of stuff. But it was like a flashback to the 1970s, the intensity. Ah. And then there was all those other storylines because the Red Wings had the Russian Five. They had an approach to hockey. The Avs had their approach. They had a different kind of thing. They had all the skilled guys that they had managed to get. We talk about it and deal with it, of course, how they accumulated all the players like Forsberg and guys like that when they were in Quebec City and then moved them all to Denver. And we talked about those guys. In fact, I saw an interview 2 or 3 days ago with Chris Draper. He's still working for the Red Wings. And they asked him sitting there in the booth, what was it like? You know, that check, Claude Lemieux, et cetera. So I remember that. And I met Claude Lemieux afterwards. I'd sort of known him from interviewing, but I met him afterwards because he became a player agent and talked to him. And, you know, very smart guy, very cagey guy. Yeah. And I certainly never approved of what he did, but I understood the context. It was full contact and everybody was really into it.
Well, and when they brought him here to Denver, you spoke about what Colorado was. Colorado was a skilled team. They didn't have a whole lot of nasty to them, though. He kind of had to fill that role. They didn't have those kind of guys. They had guys that were great skaters and speedy and powerful and quick, but not that kind of nasty. We'll mix it up. We'll get it dirty. And Claude did kind of fill that role, didn't he?
He sure did. Well, I'd seen him do it with the Montreal Canadiens before, so it didn't surprise me. And the other really interesting thing, and I think that made a difference to the Avs, and again, we deal with it when we talk about the trade, Patrick's trade from the Canadiens to the Avs, was that Patrick, he had swag. He was a swag kind of guy. He was a guy who got under your skin when you played against him. He was so good, and he let you know he was good. And I think that was a very important thing for that team, because most of the team leaders were really good players, but they weren't like guys who intimidated you with their mouths or anything like that. You had Forsberg and Sakic and those guys. They were terrific players. But Patrick coming in gave them some attitude, some swag, and they would go into a visiting rink, and teams would be just, you know, look at him in the net and go like, what the heck is going on with this guy? And, you know, he had all his little idiosyncrasies and stuff. So I think that Patrick, to a certain extent, took attention away from those guys, let them do their job. He was willing to be the guy who was that everybody hated in the other rink. And he was also, of course, the best goalie probably of his decade.
Yeah, no, you're right. And when you think back to those teams, the biggest thing I still take away is just the amount of talent on two teams. Yeah. Oh my goodness. They were all-star teams. Absolutely unbelievable amount of talent on both sides. Just incredible.
And that's the end of the pre-salary cap era. That's the era when if owners wanted to spend the money, they could spend the money. Some did, some didn't. It cost two of the Canadian cities lost their teams because the Canadian market couldn't keep up with them. But you were able to have owners. I believe it was still the Kroenkes, wasn't it, that owned the Avs at the time? I think it was the Kroenkes. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think it was the Kroenkes, yeah.
And the Illiches in Detroit. And both families made commitments to be the best and go and get the best players. And I can remember the Red Wings at trade deadline going out and getting guys like Wendell Clark and people like that. And in those days, you could do that and assemble them. And again, it sort of gets back to the book that I wrote, Deal With It, about salary caps. The thing I liked about it was you saw best on best with those teams. You saw the best teams a lot of the time. And I think that the NHL would be well advised to have, you know, sort of like soccer in England, maybe 20 teams in the top division with all the best players concentrated there. The idea of going to 32, 36, 38 teams, I think just waters down the product. And when we saw those games, and, you know, you made a great point there. When you saw those games, you knew you were seeing skill. You knew you were seeing the best guys. It wasn't like, oh, they can afford two good lines and the other two lines they're just sort of inventing. And you've got two defensemen who can turn left and two who can turn right and nobody else. You know, I like the idea of best on best. I would like to see it come back a little bit more.
Scotty Bowman, one of the greatest coaches in NHL history. Did you have interaction with Scotty? What do you remember about Mr. Bowman? How was he to deal with?
I thought I had dealt with him in the past, you know, like a lot of people in scrums or whatever it was. And I was doing a book on the skills in hockey. It's called Ice and Man. And one of the chapters was about Steve Yzerman. And I went in to do an interview with Scotty about Steve. And I was just shocked. He knew all about me. He'd read my books.
Wow.
The previous book I'd done was about hockey sticks, and I'd done again a book about the pension lawsuit and other things. And he knew all that sort of stuff. And, you know, he had a reputation for being hard as a coach. There were a lot of people who didn't like him, that he had attitude. But for me, he was always really generous. If you asked a smart question, he'd give you a great answer and stuff like that. So I was at every time I saw him, even after he retired, he would remember me and we would chat a little bit. He came from a suburb in Montreal, just next door to where my mother grew up. And so that was kind of a point of reference we would talk about. My uncle was the general manager of the junior team in a place called Lachine, a suburb called Lachine in Montreal. And Scotty grew up right next door in Verdun. And those two towns or two cities were kind of at rivalries. And so I could talk to Scotty about that kind of thing. Yeah, he was really interesting. And the great thing about him and Steve Yzerman was, he took over the team and he took Steve aside and he said, Steve, you can score 60 goals and get 150 points every year if you want, but we're not going to win the Stanley Cup. Here's how we're going to win the Stanley Cup with you as our captain. And Steve made the sacrifice.
Sure.
He put his ego in check. He let the Russian guys, the young guys, come in and be the stars offensively. And he made sure he was the guy who kept everything together. And I had a lot of respect for him. And as I say, was Scotty too, a voracious reader. He's read everything that I've ever written in terms of a book, which impressed me. Yeah.
Oh, that's very, very cool.
Yeah.
I've got to ask this, and I want to get into, you know, the Stanley Cup playoffs a little bit this year. Here in Colorado, we know we kind of cheated. We got that first title. You know, Quebec comes in here. We get to take that wonderful team that we just inherited. We hadn't bled for that team. We hadn't paid any of the price. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, the Nuggets and the Rockies keep us humble. The Broncos yeah. even keep us humble at times. Have you forgiven us for us getting that easy one yet? Or has the hockey world gotten over that? Now we've had to pay for it a little bit.
Well, it was kind of like a bailiff sale, you know. You got a fabulous house at a bailiff sale, but didn't pay the full price.
No,
God
you're right.
Bless you. You were there, and you know you took advantage. And I don't have any resentment for it. But yeah, you know, you hadn't bled that much.
No, we hadn't. You kind of got in there. I would admit that.
And the Quebec team had a history with Montreal, a rivalry with Montreal. And to see it all sort of turned around was kind of, you know, was hard for people. But
sure.
It's losing that makes you a sports fan. It's not winning. It's no, all right. Those years when you're, you know, you're cheering for the Nuggets and they stink, or yep. You're cheering for the Flames and they never make the play, whatever it is. Those are the years that really harden you as a sports fan, and you become, you know, united with the other people who root for the team because you're all going through this together.
Yes.
I won't say it's like a bad divorce, but it's traumatic going yeah. through a lot. Like the city of Calgary today is kind of in mourning because last night their team was eliminated and the season's over. The dream of whatever it might be is over. So, you know, we love to see the Avalanche come in because they're always a skilled team. They're fun to watch. They make you play your best to beat them. And the other good thing, I should say this too, about the Avs in those days was they got everybody's best game.
Yes, they
would go somewhere and people wouldn't just, oh, ho-hum, here comes Colorado. They would say, this is a benchmark game. And they got everybody's best game and they played up to that level, which I think is something that's really, really commendable.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, I've always said that it's not the losing, it's the almost winning that really...
Yes, that's maybe, yeah.
The almost winning is the one that really... Boy, that really builds something in you. You got some character if you almost won and then didn't.
That's what they call it in betting. What a bad beat.
Yes, yeah. A bad beat. You're absolutely right.
It's the bad beats that they kill you. Yeah, I know. Well, again, as an Expo fan back in those days, before I got into the media, the Expos came in '69 to Montreal, and two of the players settled in our neighborhood, and I got to know the first catcher for the Expos, John Bateman, and Gary Sutherland was the second baseman, and I became a real Expos fan as a result of knowing them.
Sure.
And they were the always close but never a cigar team. Before they had the wild cards and second place things, they were always finishing behind somebody. So I had my PhD in bad beats, that's for sure.
Bruce, when you look at the Stanley Cup playoffs this year, and like you spoke to, the league is more watered down now. And as a result, I think we see so many more upsets. We see top seeds go down sometimes in the first round. Because it's so spread out and it's so thin, it just is a different era. But is there a team you're looking at right now in the Stanley Cup playoffs and you're saying, I don't know, it might be theirs to lose?
Yeah, you know, the big thing that I've learned in the modern era, let's say the last 20 years of following a Stanley Cup team, is you need real skill to get there, but you need luck to win. And by luck, I mean you have to stay healthy. I've seen so many teams fall apart just because they lost guys at the end. That's going to be a big part of it. There's a sentimental thing. Winnipeg was the best team in the league this year. They won the President's Trophy. They have never won a Stanley Cup. They lost their team for a while. The city did. That'd be a nice sentimental thing.
Sure.
I just don't know about their depth. I think that the road is going to lead, certainly in the West, is going to lead through Vegas, probably Dallas as well, teams that have been hardened over the last number of years. I think those are teams that you have to look at. In the East, you know, for Canadians too, we haven't had a Stanley Cup winner from Canada since 1993. The Canadians in 93, with guess who, Patrick Roy, or the last Canadian team to win the NHL. So there is some sentiment that Edmonton with Connor McDavid, and they got within a game last year, or else the Leafs with Matthews and Nylander and those guys, but one of those two teams might win. But again, it'll just come down to, can you keep your guys healthy? Do you have seven or eight defensemen? Because that's sometimes what you need. I hearken back to 2011 with the Canucks. They literally ran out of guys. They were playing their eighth and ninth defenseman in their depth chart in the final. And you can't win that way. And it's really kind of too bad. So we'll wait and see how it goes. I hope that we have a legitimate champion, a good champion.
I do too. Yeah. I do too. Yeah. Is there a team that you look at that maybe not even one of the top teams, but, you know, I kind of look at St. Louis and I go, you know, if Binnington just gets hot, he might carry him. Is there a team you look at like that, that could just get hot and just get on a roll?
Yeah. You look around at the teams that have a goalie that you think can carry. Well, and then I say that, and of course the year that Vegas won the cup, what are they at? They had five different goalies.
You're right. Yeah.
But typically that would be the thing. And that's one reason why you've got to sort of like Winnipeg's chances. Because they've got the best goalie or one of the top two or three goalies in the league.
Sure.
That they would be a team. The East is so there's no hard and fast team in the East. No. But I always like, you know, as a sort of unsung team, I always like to talk about Carolina. I think Carolina is a team to keep their eye on, because if they stay healthy, the East is wide open. And I think that there's a path for them to get through. They've already won a Stanley Cup, so it's not like the city doesn't know what it's like. But yeah,
right.
It's they'd be a team I'd look at. And in the West, Dallas is a team that that they're always a contender. As I say, Edmonton, we'll just have to see what happens, how healthy Connor McDavid is.
Right. Well, and I look at, you know, Colorado's matchup in that first round with Dallas, and it just scares me so much.
Well, yeah.
So deep. They're so talented. They even come back with Moose and get to bring him back to us.
Well, if this was the NBA, this would be a third round matchup. But we've got two of the top five or six teams in the NHL. One of them's going to be eliminated in the first round, which is nice in some ways. But in other ways, it's kind of like, geez, you know, you want the best teams to get to the end. And sometimes we just see these Cinderellas kind of waffling through. They don't get injuries, and they kind of get nice, matchups. And oftentimes with teams, it is about head-to-head matchups. It's about horses for courses. And there are teams that sometimes are poison for a really good team, and they trip them up. So that's something to watch out for. The LA Kings are a team. I believe they're supposed to play the Oilers in the first round. They almost tripped them up the last 2 years. And I would think that'd be a team to watch for an upset.
Yeah, you're right. And if Edmonton does come in and they're not fully healthy, it's going to be very interesting. You know, this year with Colorado, you know, that front office just said, hey, we don't like the goaltender situation. We're just going to shuffle the entire room. We're going to just keep tweaking and making moves and keep kind of try to find a good fit and a good balance. Do you give us any chance? Can Colorado do anything?
Well, and that's one of the things, again, that I pointed out, and we talked about it earlier, talking about what Vegas did and how Vegas got from 0 to 100 miles an hour within 5 years. And Vegas never stopped turning it over the Leafs. We got a guy who's pretty acceptable there. Now we can do better. And they were insatiable with that, and they always kept going. And so when I look at your team, I don't say, oh, well, they can't make up their mind. What are they doing? All these stupid changes. Right. That's the model that Vegas has made popular, which is you can always do a little bit better. And if you do, and you've got that chance, you got to go for it. So I think they have a chance. You've got, you know, some really skilled guys. I think as long as you stay healthy with your frontline guys, you're okay. Goaltending, well, we'll have to see how it goes. Dallas is a good team, but they also, you know, they've had some failures in the past few years themselves, so they have some self-doubt as well.
Sure. No, it's going to be a lot of fun. And, you know, I know here in the States, there are so many things to watch. There are so many other things to do that hockey doesn't get the recognition that it should. But when you're talking about playoff hockey and you're talking about every single shift is just life or death, it just does not get better than Stanley Cup playoff hockey. It is just absolutely amazing. Now, we've talked a little bit. We've looked at the Stanley Cup. We've looked at some history stuff. Bruce, is there a thing that you look at right now and you say, you know, back when I first started, I don't know if I would have gone at this the same way. Is there any way that you look at how you've changed now and said, you know, I think my outlook has kind of changed a little bit compared to where it was?
Well, we all learn as we go through. I mean, lots of shows and stories that I just put my hand over my eyes and say, how did that happen? But I like to think that I just tried to push things and do things a slightly different way in my career and not be follow the pack. And that had good things and that had things that didn't work out. So, it gets back to what I tell people when they want to get into our business. I always just tell them, and I think you hinted at it too, when you get an opportunity, take it. And don't look around and say, oh, how is everybody else doing it? I'll imitate that. Be you. And if you fail, that's okay. You failed being you, you know, doing that. So most of the time, and I'd have to ask my wife, maybe she'll disagree with me, but most of the time, the results of stuff, I think, was for me being honest with myself and being who I was. And that was being kind of lippy and impertinent. As I say, when I did all the stuff, the political stuff with the NHL and the legal stuff, there were a lot of people who were very, you know, antagonized with me. The Hockey Night in Canada broadcast, they wanted nothing to do. They wouldn't let me go on their show because I wasn't good for business. I was rattling the cup and making people uncomfortable. So, you know, I paid a price for that, but I would do it 100 times out of 100. I would follow the story where it took me, even if it cost me, let's say, you know, sitting on a panel somewhere.
If I give you just your wish list, I'm Santa Claus and I can give you whatever. Is there one story that you go, that's the story I wish I could have covered? That's the one I would have loved to have been in that room.
Love to go back and do the Gretzky gambling story. That was considering what's happening with him politically in Canada. You know, sometimes there's only so much you can do. And for a while I was a local reporter, so I didn't have a national canvas to paint on. Then when I got on the national level, I kind of lost touch with some of the local stuff. I had to cover national stories. So there were things that you just saw go by that you would love to have covered, but you couldn't do it. A lot of my friends in the business were guys who were doing the deadline stuff, writing on deadline, etc. Ironically, one of my friends, his son just married my daughter this last summer.
Wow.
So we're related. But anyhow, those guys were always there. When I was an electronic guy, I had to go off and do my stuff with the studio, etc. Whereas those guys would do their stuff on deadline, and then they go out and have a beer afterwards and hang out together and talk a lot. So I never was part of that scene, and it was partly because I wasn't doing that type of a job. And it didn't give me the insights into some things. But as one, you know, one last thing to tell you about, when I was starting in the business, especially on TV, I wanted to do big stories. I wanted to have a story that, you know, I could hang my hat on and say, oh, he's the guy that did that story, or whatever. And the turning point for me was I learned that agents were the best guys to talk to. Agents had no problem with telling you things that were going on. If you talked to a player in the dressing room, he'd give you the old, oh, yeah, one leg at a time. And the management guys, oh, yeah, you know, we think we're doing fine. And it's so boring. You get tired of it. But I discovered agents who had lots of interesting things to tell me. And a lot of the best stories all came from them. And that was just something I learned along the side. And I had three or four really good sources who helped me out. And I did books with them and about them and about the things that they introduced me to. So I was very lucky to figure that out. There's a lot of guys who are still punching the same clock, doing the same sort of gig, you know, 30 years later. And frankly, I feel sorry for them a little bit.
Yeah, no, I could understand that completely. Bruce, yeah. I have to thank you so much for coming in. I have enjoyed our conversation. It has been just so, so interesting to get to talk to you. I would love to get to do this again sometime and get to talk with you some more. Bruce, I just started your book, Deal With It. I am engrossed. I absolutely love it. Where can people find your work? Where's the best place to find it?
Well, the best place to go on Amazon Books, and you can find it there. It's in Kindle, and it's also in book form. We don't have a hardcover for this one. We self-published. My son and I have done the last two books, and we've self-published this time, which is a whole other experience, which I'm really enjoying. And so if you want to help us out a little bit, you mentioned it earlier, my book website is called brucedobiganbooks.ca, and all my books are there, including a couple of non-sportsmen that I've done as well. So if you could go there and pick them up, I'm sure you'll enjoy them. If you have as much fun reading them as I did writing them, then it'll be fun.
I've got to ask one final question. Do you have something else you're working on right now? Is there something in the works that we might want to be aware of?
Well, my son works at the Canadian equivalent of ESPN. He's a stats guy. He does their social media site called Stats Center for them. And so he and I talk about story ideas all the time. So we're kicking one around. We were thinking about maybe doing a book about overtimes, famous overtime games, something along those lines. So yeah, we'll see what happens next. I'm not that young anymore. So the writing process can be a little bit more torturous than it used to be. But something along those lines. And yeah, I'd be happy to do it. I did a couple of biographies with people that never got published. over the years, and maybe I'll just revive one of those ones. Once the guys boot off, I can probably do it without getting sued.
Well, Bruce, I thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I was looking forward to this. Just knowing your background and knowing some of the things you've done, I couldn't wait to talk to you. It absolutely lived up to the hype. You did a phenomenal job, and I just want to thank you for visiting the Daily Dose, and I genuinely mean it. I would love to not be strangers. I would love to have you back again sometime for sure.
And anytime, Clinton. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it to talk about the book. And again, as when you're self-publishing, you need to, you know, have to market your book, and finding people like yourself who are really interested in pushing it. That I'm very grateful for that.
Hey, next week on The Dose, we are going to continue our run of talking to some very interesting people in the world of sports. Trust me, you will not want to miss what I have in store for you next week. It's going to be very, very interesting. So be sure you tune into The Dose, and be sure you let a friend know to do the same. Hey, I want to say thank you so much to author and announcer Bruce Dobigan for spending some time with us today. I really enjoyed our conversation. I hope you'll stay in touch. And I want to say thank you to each and every one of you for listening to The Daily Dose every week. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for the texts. Thank you for the tweets. Thank you for going over to DailyDoseSports.com and checking out the new things going up there every week. But more than anything, thank you for sharing the show, for sharing the videos, for sharing the articles with someone that you know. We absolutely love it when you do that. Have to say thank you to JSP. Could not do any of this without you. I will see you all next Wednesday. Have a great week, everybody.